This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hello and welcome. Welcome to our very first edition of Stateside. It is no exaggeration to tell you all that joining the team here at Michigan Radio and helping to create this brand new show has been one of the most exciting, most energizing things that I have ever been a part of. And I am so glad that you stopped in to join us. We've put a lot of thought into what we want to bring you each week here on Stateside. Our goal for the hour we'll spend together each Thursday? To discover stories and meet people from every corner of Michigan. We intend to cover a broad range of news and policy stories. We'll track what's happening around Michigan on the cultural front. And we will discover and highlight people who are doing what they can to make Michigan a better place for us to live. We will be respectful. We will be open-minded. And we want to hear from you, whether through email, your phone calls, on Facebook or Twitter, or your letters. What matters to you? What worries you? What's happening in your community that we should celebrate? If it matters to you, it matters to us, and we really look forward to talking with you. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, on Twitter at Stateside Radio, or, of course, online at michiganradio.org. So as we launch this brand new show that is all about Michigan, we thought, let's start at the very top. Let's hear from our governor and see what's on his mind midway through his term. Governor Rick Snyder, thank you so much for being the very first guest on Stateside.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I'm glad to hear you're kicking off a show like this.
Well, we really want to look at Michigan issues, and who better to start with than the governor of Michigan? And I have to say, when I was reading the Free Press during the Republican convention last week, and I know you were there as a governor, I love the fact that we all got to look at your campaign ID from 1976 when you were there for your first convention as Gerald Ford's campaign worker. Did you give yourself a moment of pride saying to yourself, okay, look what's happened since 1976, since that campaign ID was taken?
Well, yeah, I've been very fortunate to have a great career and a wonderful family, and it's nice to look back and see it. Yeah, it's been very fruitful and worthwhile. So it was great. It was nice to have the picture. I think people got a lot of fun seeing with me with long hair and brown hair.
And there you were as the governor of Michigan. And certainly there was a lot of talk, Governor Snyder, in Tampa about the importance of delivering the Michigan vote to Governor Romney in November. What do you personally think are the chances of turning Michigan from a blue state to a red state? What would it take?
Well, I think there are good chances. And I told that to their campaign. I think there's good opportunity. It's really their decision to make on how many resources they'll put into the state. Because if you look at it, for many years it had been voting Democratic in presidential elections, but there was a major sweep in 2010 for the Republicans, and the track record that we've been able to show about what we've been doing in Michigan is very, very strong.
You know, Governor, obviously you are supporting Romney, but it strikes me we rarely, if ever, hear you say anything directly negative about President Obama.
I don't. I, to my knowledge, I haven't, and I won't. I just don't believe in that. Public service is a major challenge on anyone. And then secondly, we need to partner with the federal government and local government, and we want to work in a positive, constructive way. I don't believe in doing negative activities, and I stick to the positive side of things. That's relentless positive action and action.
I recall meeting with you 2 years ago when you were that businessman exploring a run for governor. You were meeting with media people around the state. Well, here we are 20 months after you did it, you became governor. And I'm wondering, how do the realities and the pressures of serving in this office compare to what you thought the job would be like when you were sitting there and considering that run?
It's reasonably close. I mean, the good part is that I had started new businesses or done new things in my career in the past. And as part of that, you always know you're not going to know a lot of things. So you sort of build into that capability of, you know, coming into new situations and learning, you know, there's more complexity here, there's more difficulties there. So I was prepared for that, but it's been a great experience. It's been an honor to be governor of Michigan, and it's a chance to go help people. And as you recall, that was my goal. That was my only real goal, is to reinvent Michigan in a positive way, and I feel good. We've gotten a lot done. We got a lot more to do, though. I mean, it's only partially done. So I'm proud that we're the comeback state in the United States today. But I'm not complacent nor content with where we're at. I want to go even faster in making us the best state in the country.
I actually want to kind of build on that. There was a big headline in this past Sunday's Free Press basically saying that 27% of all Michigan workers are really stuck in jobs where they can't They can barely earn a living, and five of the seven occupations that employ the greatest number of workers in our state cannot bring a family of four out of poverty. What do you think needs to happen to break this cycle of low-wage jobs in Michigan?
Well, a lot of it is connecting people with the right opportunities and make sure they get the right training and skill set. And that's something I've been working hard on is I think skilled trades is a huge opportunity in Michigan. As I travel around Michigan and talk to businesses, they actually have openings, and they could grow faster and better. I met one company up at the Upper Peninsula that literally had to turn down a contract because they couldn't get enough skilled trades people fast enough. So that's something we're really working hard on. We started last year when we launched mitalent.org, which is a website that has thousands of openings in Michigan and can help people look at career opportunities. We're going to make a major upgrade of that site this fall, and that is one of the fall's priorities is to get that upgrade in place because there is too much underemployment, and we need to work unemployment and underemployment. I think we can do much better, and we will, and we're going to help lead the nation by going after talent the right way, which really is a skilled trades are a big piece of that.
Governor Snyder, thanks for taking time, and we will look forward to talking with you in the future on Stateside.
It was great to be with you.
From our Republican governor, just back from the Republican National Convention, to the Democrats. Tonight brings the emotional high point of the Democratic National Convention, the speech from President Barack Obama. All week long, Michigan Radio's Lester Graham has been in North Carolina covering the convention and the Michigan delegation. Lester, as you heard, we just talked to Governor Snyder about the GOP hopes of turning Michigan to a red state. What are you hearing from Michigan delegates, and how confident are they that they can deliver Michigan again to President Obama?
I wouldn't say they're confident. I think they're optimistic. They know they have some work to do. Their biggest effort is get out the vote because there's not yet quite the excitement that there was 4 years ago. So they're worried about that, but they think they can overcome that by just getting people to the polls.
And how do you think, how are they planning to do that? What do they need to do to roll up their sleeves and keep Michigan a blue state?
Well, as I was reading the coverage from President Clinton's speech last night, I think they could probably take a few talking points from that speech and use it to persuade people. But I think the main thing is organization, encouraging people to not think that Obama has this sealed up. Don't take the win for granted in Michigan, that you must get to the polls because it's not. And actually, the polls show, the polling firms show that it's a dead heat race between Governor Mitt Romney and President Barack Obama in Michigan.
One of the main messages we've been hearing from the Democrats, certainly from Vice President Biden, is Barack Obama saved GM and Chrysler. Of course, Biden is in Detroit and all around the country saying Osama bin Laden is dead and GM's alive. How has this whole issue of the auto bailout been playing so far at the convention?
Well, it was key last night. We heard from UAW President Bob King. We heard from others who mentioned it. President Clinton also talked about how important the recovery of the auto industry was for the Midwestern states, including Michigan, especially Michigan. So that's going to be something that in Michigan we're going to hear a lot from the Democrats, reminding people that while we have seen some cutbacks, we could have lost both GM and Chrysler altogether and some 1 million jobs that go with those places. So I think it's going to be a key point in the Democrats' argument in Michigan.
Although we should note both GM and Chrysler have politely but firmly closed the door to either candidate doing photo ops and campaigning in their plants.
Yeah, they're not doing a lot of sponsorship here of campaign events or political events at either convention either. So I think they're trying to lie low, and GM's really trying to shake this whole government motors criticism that it's been getting.
Lester, help us place our state at this convention. By that, I mean the Republicans made a big, big deal out of Governor Romney's family ties in Michigan. And, of course, the Michigan delegates were given literally the best seats in the House right there in front of the podium at the RNC. Is Michigan getting any of that warm, fuzzy attention from the Democratic convention?
It's been getting a lot of attention from Democratic officials. A lot of people have been coming by talking to the Michigan delegates during their morning meeting. Michigan is not being ignored. They know that it's a key state. It's probably not the top five or six, but it's certainly a very important one. And I think as the polls have been coming in, as I mentioned earlier, the Obama campaign is a little more concerned about Michigan than it might have been.
And finally, as we look forward to President Obama's acceptance speech tonight, I want to explore with you a little bit the overall enthusiasm for the president at the convention. Of course, 4 years ago, Democrats were so thrilled about then-Senator Barack Obama. What do you feel this year? Is there that enthusiasm gap, and is it more about we don't want to elect Mitt Romney than we do want to reelect Barack Obama?
It's been interesting. Throughout the convention this week, it has been building. Everybody was kind of thought that First Lady Michelle Obama's speech was sweet and inspiring. They got fired up last night after hearing President Clinton, and I suspect that today it's going to be quite an exciting time for the delegates who are gathered. They are ready to campaign for this president, I believe. At least that's what they're saying. And I think you can see it in the way they're behaving at the convention as well.
Lester Graham covering the Democratic National Convention in North Carolina for Michigan Radio. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's a birthday party for a war, and we're all invited. The 200th anniversary of the War of 1812, where the fighting might have happened in what is now your backyard, or perhaps your favorite golf course. And writer Mitch Albom joins us to talk about his latest book, The Timekeeper. Those stories and much more still ahead on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Reports about West Nile virus over the summer have certainly been attention-grabbing. When we hear words epidemic proportions, we tend to sit up and take notice. Just yesterday, West Nile claimed another life in Michigan. I've heard teenage girls worrying about going on a camping trip. We heard a little boy tell his dad, "I don't want to hike on the trail with you. I'm worried about mosquitoes and West Nile virus." Dr. Dean Cinco is the interim chief medical executive for the Michigan Department of Community Health. Dr. Cinco, what is your view of the West Nile situation in Michigan?
Well, I mean, I believe we're having increased activity, clearly, in Michigan. I'm calling this an epidemic of West Nile disease. However, I think we can continue to engage in the activities and enjoy the outdoors throughout the duration of this season. I think if people are concerned, they can take certain precautions. Again, keep in mind that the vast majority of people who become infected with this virus do not fall ill. So it has to be all put into context. This can be a very serious, it can be a life-threatening disease, but I think putting it into proper perspective and taking good precautions, we can mitigate the effects of this situation.
And what would be some of the precautions that you'd like people of all ages in Michigan to keep in mind?
Well, I mean, the steps that we recommend are avoiding outdoor activities to the extent we can from dusk to dawn, wearing long sleeve clothing or long pants when outdoors, particularly at that time of the day, using insect repellents, and ensuring that your screens and doors are well-maintained to keep these mosquitoes out of your home at night.
I want to ask a little more about this decreasing your outside activity from dusk to dawn. So if someone's going camping, are we kind of saying don't be outside? Because I could see that alarming people as they hear that.
Mm-hmm. No, we're not saying don't be outside. We're saying if you have an option to avoid being outside, particularly for people who might be most vulnerable to this disease, and granted, it can infect anyone and cause anyone to be sick, but typically it has most serious consequences for people over age 50, and the older we get, the greater that risk is.
Dr. Cinco, as of today, we're at 6 deaths in our state and more than 120 cases. Now, how does that compare to the worst year we've had? What has been Michigan's worst year, and how does this fit in?
Well, the worst year was 2002 when we had our first exposure to this virus, and we had over 600 cases at that time, and there were dozens of deaths, as I recall. So we're much lower than the 2002 experience so far. But we are substantially higher than any year since then. On average, we've seen maybe 20 to 30 cases a year with two deaths, and we're much above that this year.
Dr. Dean Cinco from the Michigan Department of Community Health, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And one of the biggest environmental stories in our state this year comes from the west side of Michigan, near South Haven on the shores of Lake Michigan. That's where you'll find the Palisades Nuclear Power Plant, which it seems just can't stop itself from getting into trouble. So much so that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has declared Palisades is one of the worst performing plants in the entire country. Tonight, Palisades is holding an open house for neighbors to come ask questions and air their concerns. Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith has been following this story. Lindsay, recap for us. Why has Palisades earned this less than reassuring distinction?
Well, they had, in 2011, they had four reactor shutdowns that were not planned. And that's usually because something messes up that they don't expect to happen. And there was a couple of issues. The biggest one had to do with an electrical outage where a worker didn't follow work procedures, and he was doing some electrical work, and there was a big short circuit. It wiped out half of the control room indicators for plant workers that are controlling the plant. That's a pretty big deal. So that was deemed a substantially significant a safety violation, and that's really what got them to have this designation.
And there have been problems this year as well.
Yeah, well, they haven't been arguably as bad because they haven't had any real unplanned shutdown events. They have shut down numerous times throughout the year to repair problems, though. Particularly, they've had problems with leaks this year. There was a couple of times where water leaked into the control room. There was a leaking tank that's above the control room that may have been part of that problem. There was also a leak that they just fixed that was in the actual reactor. The reactor has a bunch of water to keep the nuclear reactor cool, and there was a bunch of water leaking out of that as well. So they have fixed that. They have restarted. But yeah, they've definitely had some issues this year too.
And a week from today, we've got the Nuclear Regulatory Commission having its own open meeting to talk about how the operators of Palisades are doing. What do we know, Lindsay, about this report from the NRC and what we might hear a week from today?
So this meeting is particularly to go over a safety culture assessment. It's an independent third party that did this assessment. So it's not the NRC, but it's an independent firm. And Entergy hired them. They were required to by the NRC. Because of those, particularly the electrical problem where a worker got permission to not follow procedures, that was a really big deal. And so that was part of the reason why they had to have this safety culture assessment. Now, this report we don't have because it was done by an independent party, and so it's not part of the public record. However, we do have the executive summary, and it details a lack of accountability of all levels is one that a quote that really stood out to me. Another is that there's a lack in the belief that Palisades management really wants problems reported or that the issues will be addressed. So this is people that work in the plant and that report to managers. So the NRC is going to go over this report in detail, really sort of flesh some of this stuff out. I expect that there will be a lot of questions that the NRC will really grill them on.
Well, Lindsay, all of this really seems to beg the question, if I'm living within the shadow of Palisades, how worried should I be? Is Palisades safe?
I always have to say, first and foremost, that the NRC insists that the plant is operating safely, and if it were not, it would shut the plant down. And I, you know, throughout the past year, I have asked them numerous times, you know, every time something like this comes up, is it safe? Is it okay? Because that's really what people care about, right? So they've always said that the plant is operating safely, and if it wasn't, that they would shut it down. However, these are problems are not usual. They're not common. So it's something that they certainly are keeping a better eye on. That's part of the reason why I've done a lot more reporting on it this year. And it's not common, but it's not that, you know, in the NRC's mind, if it was a big problem, they would shut it down if it wasn't safe.
Lindsay Smith is Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter. Lindsay, thank you so much for the update today.
Oh, no, thank you.
a troubled nuclear power plant, West Nile virus. That was a lot to think about. Let's change gears a bit. Let's give a shout out to a man who may just have set the new gold standard for generous bosses. Longtime Ann Arbor auto dealer Howard Cooper is retiring this month. As his employees reported for work yesterday, they got an unexpected expression of Mr. Cooper's appreciation, a check for $1,000 for every year of service, all 89 employees. George Davis is the general manager. George, people's reactions must have been what?
Well, this is going to sound kind of silly. It wasn't shock in any place because Howard is so good to us and he's so close to us that surprised there was a huge amount of money involved, yes, but not surprised that Howard would make this kind of a gesture because he's so caring of the people that work for him. It is what makes us be what we are today. But just, I can explain it this way. I have 20 years of seniority here, and there's a dozen or more people that are here longer than me.
Sounds like an incredible boss, setting very high standards for bosses everywhere, right, George?
Yeah, I've worked at a couple of car dealers and seen them sold. I've not seen anything like this done before, whether it's car dealership or bakery or whatever. There's just not a lot of people like Howard, so not all are going to think this way. And I think in one of the papers I read, how the CEOs walk away with a big bonus and the golden parachute and the troops get nothing. Howard never acted that way when he owned the business and surely didn't act that way when he sold the business.
Well, George, you had mentioned you've been with Howard for 20 years, so we can do the math. What are you going to do with your money?
Well, I'm fortunate. I think I'm going to put it in the bank and just, and that's another part of the equation that I'm watching very closely is we have some people that receive checks. This is a windfall. This is like a lottery to them. And it's my responsibility to ensure that they handle it properly. So I've counseled with a lot of people already today and yesterday afternoon so that they get good direction and good advice because some of them, it's more money probably than they've ever had in the bank before. And we want to make sure they spend it wisely. And I feel it's my responsibility to help them in any way I can there.
George Davis, he's the general manager of Howard Cooper in Ann Arbor.
Cindy, it's been a pleasure.
Well, there's a huge party going on right now on Detroit's riverfront. It's the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812. Great Britain and the new United States of America slugging it out over trade and over that nasty British habit of grabbing American sailors and forcing them to serve King George. Yes, that same King George, the one we beat in the Revolutionary War. All week long, running until next Monday, it's the War of 1812 bicentennial, and it's Navy Week with events happening all over Southeast Michigan. More on that in a bit. First, let's brush up on our history as we're joined by historian Jim McConnell. Jim, it strikes me the War of 1812 might be just a wee bit overlooked by a lot of us. Does it lose out a little to the Revolutionary War or the Civil War?
Well, the one good thing about the War of 1812 is that everybody knows when it started because nobody knows when the Civil War started. Secondly, it was very important to Michigan because the first major battles of the War of 1812 were fought around Detroit and around Mackinac Island.
Give us some of the names of these battles, Jim.
The Battle of Mackinac Island was fought on July the 17th, 1812, and it really wasn't a battle. The British caught the fort by surprise, and the fort surrendered without firing a shot. August the 5th was the Battle of Brownstown, which is just south in the Downriver area, and that was a British victory. Americans trying to get supplies up to Detroit were defeated. And then 4 days later, they tried again on August the 9th at the Battle of Monkwagon, which is the old Indian name for Wyandotte. The battle was fought kind of south of Wyandotte all the way down to Trenton. And then certainly on August the 16th, 1812, the fall of Detroit was a shock to President Madison and to all the rest of the people across the country. It certainly broke the spirit of the Americans at the start of the war.
Jim, fill us in a little bit more. What was the root cause of the war? We've been through the Revolutionary War. goodbye, England. Goodbye, King George. We are now, the United States of America. So why was it a few short years later we're back at war with them?
Well, I tend to blame it on Napoleon Bonaparte because he's a very highly recognizable name in world history. Bonaparte had taken control of France and was involved in an ongoing war with England. Neither France nor England wanted the United States to carry on trade with their enemy. And so they both began to interfere with American trade. But the British, having a bigger navy, were interfering more effectively than were the French. So we began to view the British as our enemy because they were limiting our trade with the European continent, in particular with France. In addition, we really believed that the British were still trying to control the fur trade up in the old Northwest, including Michigan, by providing supplies to the Native Americans, who would then stir up trouble against the American settlers. And so for those reasons, we thought we should declare war, and President Madison sent a message to Congress on June the 1st, 1812, and within 3 weeks, Congress, in a fairly close vote, declared war against Great Britain. Mm-hmm. It was the first time in American history that Congress had voted to declare war.
As this war went on, how long did it, you said it went on starting, of course, in 1812 and went for?
Really a little bit over 2.5 years. The fighting in 1813, after we won the Battle of Lake Erie, we defeated the British army that was over at Amherstburg and that had been occupying Detroit. We defeated them at the Battle of Moraviantown in October 1813. They fell back to the Niagara region, and the fighting continued in that area in 1813, 1814. Then it went over to the East Coast in 1813, 14, and 15. And, of course, the most famous things to come out of the war were the national anthem, which was inspired by the British attack on Fort McHenry near Baltimore.
Yes.
And the flag was seen by Francis Scott Key. The flag was made at the direction of the commander of the fort, a guy by the name of George Armistead. And Armistead did indeed want a flag that was big enough for the British to see. And the next morning on September the 14th, the flag was indeed there, and it inspired Francis Scott Key. And it was after that the British defeated Napoleon. They were tired of fighting the United States, so they began to look for peace talks, and so they finally met in Ghent, in modern-day Belgium, and on December the 24th, 1814, they agreed to a treaty of peace.
You know, you stop and think about what the stories you're telling us, Jim McConnell, and you think that here we were 200 years ago trading musket fire and cannonballs with the English. And over this past summer, there we all were celebrating the Queen and besotted with William and Kate and the London Olympics. And does that kind of tickle your historical funny bone?
Oh, I think it's very appropriate because, indeed, after the War of 1812, the peace pretty much stabilized relations between the U.S. and Canada. There were continuing conflicts. So anybody that says there was never another conflict between the United States and Canada isn't speaking truthfully. In 1838, there was a rebellion in Canada, and there were actually casualties of Americans crossing over to help the rebels fight against the Canadian government. I also like to say that the really big issue, though, was the control, not of the fur trade, but of the fudge trade. And so today, Mackinac is, of course, noted for its fudge.
It is indeed. And I think it's safe to say the major conflicts between Detroit and Canada might be when Montreal comes to play the Red Wings at the Joe Louis Arena.
That's probably true.
And Jim, I want to quickly mention the documentary that the Michigan War of 1812 Bicentennial Commission produced. It's called Michigan at War, The Struggle for the Old Northwest, 1812 to 1815. And it's going to air this coming Monday evening on Detroit Public Television. Jim McConnell, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
The 1812 Bicentennial Celebration features military band concerts, cooking competitions, precision drill teams, a military festival, and much more. And you can see the schedule on the web at 1812detroit.com. And at the same time, Navy Week in Detroit is giving us a great chance to meet sailors and Marines, to tour two U.S. Navy ships, a U.S. Coast Guard ship, a Royal Canadian Navy frigate, and an exact replica of the tall ship Niagara, which played a big part in the War of 1812. Details are at NavyWeek.org, and we have links to those sites on our website, MichiganRadio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As you hurry through your day, checking your watch, checking the clock, trying to squeeze more and more into your waking hours, do you ever stop and ask yourself, what would it be like to live without an awareness of time? How does that constant sense of time passing, time running out, affect our very existence? Mitch Albom got to wondering about these very questions, and the result is his latest novel, The Timekeeper. Mitch, I want to give our listeners a sense of what The Timekeeper is about, but I don't want to give away the goods. So I will say it's a novel about time. How else would you describe your story?
Well, it's a fable, kind of a magical novel that follows the story of an invented Father Time as he tries to teach the world what the real value of time is.
Where did you ever come up with the idea of taking such a topic as time? It certainly defies being put in a tidy box. Where did the germ of the idea come from?
Probably just getting older. You know, I've my books are somewhat interconnected with one another ever since Tuesdays with Maury. You know, when you sit and watch somebody die, first you go through a lot of things about yourself, how you're leading your life, and that kind of resulted in Tuesdays with Maury. Then you might think about what happens next, the afterlife. That sort of led me to the five people you meet in heaven. Hmm. You think about family, which led me to the themes of For One More Day. You think about your faith, which led me to themes for Have a Little Faith. And then ultimately, you find you're thinking about your time and how you're spending it and how you're using it. And that is clearly an issue for people today more than ever. We're so busy. So I don't know anyone who doesn't use that phrase, I'm busy, I'm really busy. You know, where's the time? I wish I had more time. And one day I was sitting by my house, and I looked outside the window, and I saw a deer run across the backyard. And you're always arrested when you see a deer anyhow.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, that deer has no idea if today's Tuesday or Thursday, no idea how long it's supposed to live. It's just existing. And that's the big difference between us and every other creature on the planet. We count time. And because we count time, we're the only creatures that worry about time running out. That germ of an idea became, wow, there's probably something there. What if I wrote about a guy who was the first person to begin counting? And how we all love to kill that guy,
yeah.
and go from there. And that's kind of how The Timekeeper came about.
Mitch, I want to zero in. I know you have three major characters, and there's Victor, there's Dor, Father Time, and there is Sarah.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, personally, Sarah sold your book to me. I was so touched by her, both because I'm the mother of a teenage girl, and also the fact that I was the nerdy bagpipe playing honor student whose dad took her to the movies the night of the prom because, of course, I didn't have a date. So I have to ask you, how did you, as that middle-aged guy, that sports writer that we know from the Free Press, so perfectly capture the heart of a struggling teen girl? Because you did it.
Well, the answer is I have 17 nieces and nephews of varying ages, and some of them were teenagers, and all of them at some point or another were. And I observed them, and I watched particularly the girls. I spent some time talking with them when I was putting this book together, and I noticed several things. They do a lot of texting. They're constantly checking things on the Internet, updating statuses, and they're just as concerned about being loved or being cool as we were when we were in high school. That hasn't changed at all.
So true.
And so in the case of Sarah, she's this kind of too smart, little too chubby, a little too tall, not good looking but not great,
mm-hmm.
You know, just on the edge kind of girl who's never really had a really handsome boy, you know, cool kid interested in her. And suddenly she finds herself in a situation where she's spending time with a kid like that and alone, him away from his friends. He's actually nice to her every now and then, throws her a bone, and she imagines this whole romance with him. And as we often sometimes do with our heart's desire, there's a line in the book that says, a desperate heart will seduce the mind. And it's true, you know, when you're lonely and she's lonely, she just creates this whole fantasy relationship with him. Well, it ends badly when he sort of has no interest in her, kind of dumps her, and then gets worse when he dumps her on the Internet.
Yes.
And that's a very modern thing.
Very.
And we've all read about kids who have felt bullied or ashamed on the Internet and have tried to drink themselves to death, hang themselves, take sleeping pills, and sometimes they succeed.
and she becomes one of those kids. And it's tragic because, of course, as adults, you want to say, oh, come on, it's no big deal, you'll get over it, you know. But for kids, this is very real. And for them, they don't want to live anymore. You hear that sentence, I want to die.
Yeah.
And Father Time in this book has to sort of stop her right at that moment and say, you can't give time back. Just as you can't take what's not yours, you can't give it back either. You're not meant to go now. You'll get over this, and you can't give away tomorrow, because tomorrow might be the day that everything changes. Tomorrow might be the day that a cure is found. Tomorrow might be the day that the answer to your prayers comes. So you can't give up on tomorrow. That's a truism of time, as much as you can't take a tomorrow that's not yours is a truism. And so I sort of used her as one example of the two people that Father Time has to talk to. She's at the young end, and then at the other end is an old man. And it was, I have to tell you, it was a lot of fun writing a teenage girl. I've never done it before. All my books seem to be about old men and middle-aged guys. It was interesting to get, you know, the way she talks. You know, she's kind of flighty. And ultimately, the way the Internet can just ruin kids was all interesting to write about.
You did such a great job with
that,
Mitch. I want to talk a little, if I can, about the different challenges and rewards of turning out the sports writing that you do, that we read in the Free Press, and crafting books like these. Because as a reporter, you're basically bringing your readers an account of something that has already happened, whether it's
right.
a game or an interview you've done. As a writer, especially in a book like The Timekeeper, you are creating it all. Which is the tougher challenge to you?
Oh, it's much tougher to create a world than it is to report on, at least for me. And maybe I'm speaking from perspective of having done the latter for 30 years. That's not so new to me anymore, whereas I'm still a relatively green novelist. This is my third novel. And what I often say is that when you're sitting and writing a nonfiction story, you write the facts of the story, and a voice in your head might say, boy, this would be a better story if he had a brother, a twin brother. Too bad he didn't. But you can't, because you're bound by the truth.
Mm.
Writing a novel, you sit there and you go, wow, this would be better if he had a twin brother. And you go, hey, I can give him a twin brother, and that's wonderful. And then another voice in your head says, what about a twin sister? You know, and the problem is, you never shut off that other voice. There's always another way you could go. You could do this. You could do that. Well, what about this? What about that? You never know if you're crafting the perfect story, because there's a thousand other possibilities where you have to go. And at some point, you just have to pick a lane and drive it and say, well, this is going to be the book I'm going to write. And maybe I'll have a twin sister in the next book, but I can't do it in this one. And that makes it difficult and much more different than the boundaries of the truth, which you have to operate by when you're doing any kind of journalism, sports writing or anything else.
When you're writing a book like your novels, like The Timekeeper, do you have a beginning and an end in mind? Or does the story take you to where the ending is?
Yeah, you know, I have some novelist friends who say they just sort of create a world and they let their characters take them.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. My characters, they look up from the page and they go, what do you mean? You tell us where to go. You don't know where we're going? Well, you expect us to do this? So they must have a whole different set of characters than me. I have to have an ending. If I don't have a North Star of sorts to sail towards, my boat will crash. I don't have to have all the middle. The easiest example of this is The Five People You Mean in Heaven, mm-hmm. book I wrote because there were five people. I knew who the protagonist was going to be, and I had a pretty good idea of who his first person was going to be, and some vague idea that somewhere he'd meet someone from his family in second, third, or fourth. But I knew who the fifth was, mm-hmm. and the fifth is the key to that whole story, if you've read that book.
Yeah.
And until I had that, I didn't have the book, and I wouldn't sit down and write it. Once I had that, I could sort of sail towards it and fill in the middle. And that's kind of what I did with The Timekeeper, too. I sort of knew that there's one overriding lesson that I wanted to get across in the book. And once I knew where I could place that, then I started to say, okay, here's what's going to happen with this teenage girl. Here's what's going to happen with this rich old man. But not before. I'm not good enough to just say, let me create characters and see where they take me. I'm sure other people are better at it than me, and they can, but my people need a map, and I'm their map.
You're kind of coloring within the lines then.
I'm within the lines.
Mitch, what did you teach yourself in writing this story?
All of my books, I say, are basically written to teach me a lesson. I am the imperfect product of the stories that I tell. And one of the hardest things I've had to realize and explain to people, starting with Tuesdays with Maury, is that he was the teacher. I was the dumb student. And while I wrote down a lot of the wisdom that he had, and people embraced that, I'm not a finished product of that wisdom. I needed to hear it, and I still do. The same thing with all the other books I've written. You know, I'm not perfect in my faith, even if I wrote a book about faith. I'm not perfect in my relationship with my mother or father, even though I wrote a book about, you know, a man regretting his relationship with his mother. And certainly I'm not perfect about time. I think you reach a certain age where you accept the fact that you aren't going to live forever. Your parents are getting older, maybe sick. In my case, both of my parents have taken strokes in the last year and become dependent, totally dependent on AIDS. And, you know, I'm getting closer to those ages myself. And you sort of realize the sand is running through your hourglass all the time. And every grain that goes through, what's important in that one is important in the other ones too. And so I have learned that I'm not going to be able to do everything in my life. You know, I'm just not. And what am I going to do with the time that I have left? And how am I going to spend it? And that's probably the overall lesson of The Timekeeper, even though it's very magical and entertaining. It's not, you know, I don't think it's a boring kind of treatise on time. It's probably the most plot-driven and vast book that I've written, even though it's like 4 inches wide. You know, and they're always short. At one point, Father Time is being sent back to Earth, and he's being sent by this angel who has been constantly asking him, you know, what do you know about time? Why did you start measuring time? Why did you start counting time? Why are you so infatuated with time? And when he sends him back to Earth, he says, there's a reason that heaven limits your days. And Father Time says, well, what's the reason? And he says, well, when you find out, you really understand time. And when he finally does, and he teaches it to this old man in the book, the answer is, you know, why are our days on Earth limited? Because that's how you make them precious. And if they weren't limited, nothing would matter. If we could live forever, like everybody wants to, nothing would be important. It's the fact that time is limited, and you don't get a million years, and you may not even get tomorrow, that forces you to make choices about, am I going to spend this day with my family? Am I going to spend it with my husband or wife? Am I going to spend it working? Am I going to spend it wrapped up in myself? And the choices you make become the quality of your life, whether it's 20 years long or 120 years long. And that's sort of the whole essence of the book, and that's really what I need to teach myself.
I think a lot of us need to learn it right there with you. Speaking of spending time and making choices, Mitch, I'd like to spend a little time talking about your charities. All of them different, all of them worthy. You certainly do get involved. 8 charities all spelled out on your website, MitchAlbum.com. What's gotten the most public support, and what do you feel needs a little more love?
Huh. That's interesting. Well, Haiti, for a period of time, probably got the biggest injection of support. And we went down and to a mission that had been falling on hard times, that had been established by a Detroit pastor many years ago. And we've taken over the operations of that for the last couple of years. And maybe because that's such a heartfelt story and people saw it on the news a lot. And we've had, you know, reporters have gone down there with us and actually covered it. The TV crews have gone down there. So a lot of support was gathered for that, but then a lot was needed.
Yeah.
Not as much for helping in our own backyard and projects that we do with Detroit. I have Say Detroit, which mm-hmm. helps the homeless, and a Hole in the Roof Foundation, which helps places of faith that take care of the homeless, and Working Homes, Working Families, which is one that I think is a great idea, but it needs the wind behind its sails. We do about a half a dozen a year, but that basically takes all these abandoned homes that there are so many of here in Detroit, fixes them up, and gives them to a working family as long as they pay the taxes and utilities and are responsible. And after 2 years, if they prove all that, then we give them the home.
Wow.
And, I mean, that to me is lemons to lemonade. And sometimes it's easier to care for somebody a world away than it is in your own backyard. I don't know why that is,
mm-hmm.
but it seems, oh, those poor kids over there. Whereas here in Detroit, sometimes people say, well, I'm working, and why can't they? You know,
yes.
It's a little too close. I try not to look at it that way. To me, people in need are people in need. And if they're 5 minutes away from me or 5,000 miles away from me, if they're in my path or there's something I can do for them, I try to. But I have to say that, in general, the giving by the people in Michigan has been remarkable. I mean, we're one of the hardest-hit states economically in the last 5 years. You would think we'd have the best excuses not to give. Like, I wish I could, but I can't. I'm mm-hmm. out of work. And instead, what happens is, I wish I could, I'm out of work, here's $20.
Wow.
You know, I wish I could give you 40 or 100, but here's 20. And it's all those 20s that add up, and people have been great.
Well, you can find out a lot more about the Detroit-based charities and the Have Faith Haiti mission on Mitch's website, which is mitchalbum.com. And certainly you can find out more about all of his books. And Mitch, I also want to commend you on your website with the great discussion guides and the reader groups and the teacher aids for your books, because it's encouraging reading, and we all need more of that. And we will put a link to your website at our webpage at michiganradio.org. Mitch, thank you very, very much for talking with us today. The book is The Timekeeper, out from Hyperion. It has really been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we will do so in the future.
I hope so, too. I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks.
And you can hear more of my conversation with Mitch Albom on our website at michiganradio.org. Mitch tells us all about a plumber from Dearborn who has rolled up his sleeves and helped to rebuild the Have Faith Haiti mission in some very, very special ways. I promise. You'll be glad you took a few minutes to hear Mitch tell this man's story. And speaking of time, and time moving a little too quickly for some, it's been kind of a heart-tugging week for families all over Michigan as the kids head back to school. Facebook was filled with photos and Instagrams of that new kindergartner or the 12th grader driving herself off to school, leaving parents wondering, how did this happen so fast? Perhaps the emotions of the week were best expressed by little Charlie Sobolewski of Flushing. As his parents, Jane and Mike, walked him into his first grade room at Springview Elementary, Charlie felt the weight of his new role as a first grader, and he started to get a little emotional. Mom asked if he was all right. Charlie's answer, "Yes, my eyeballs are just sweating." Jane says, needless to say, her eyeballs started to sweat a little too. I think it's safe to say there are a lot of sweaty eyeballs going on around this time of year. Here's to a good school year for all the Charlies around Michigan. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. We had production assistance from Allie Billings and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Tamar Charney is the station's program director. The director of broadcasting for Michigan Radio is Steve Schramm. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for sharing your day with us. Jen White and All Things Considered is up next.